From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Where have all the pennant races gone? Ahead on Only a Game, Tim Kirchen talks about the American League Central, and I hope some other stuff, too, because we have a whole hour ahead of us. Also, the story of a Texas high school athlete who single-handedly won two consecutive state track and field team titles, and a cultural history of Montreal Canadiens legend Maurice the Rocket Richard. Also ahead, a normally mirthless public radio station finds hilarity through laughter yoga. Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The Yankees sit atop the pile of ball clubs playing in autumn. They've been there lots of times, it seems, since George Steinbrenner bought them. Los Angeles is safe as well. It's safe, in fact, times two. The Phillies, Cards, and Red Sox are postseason locks. What's new? It's only in Detroit that there is doubt about who wins, and that's because the Tigers are still worried about the Twins. Tim Kirchen of ESPN joins me now to tell me if I've got all that right. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Bill. And yes, you've got that perfectly and very lyrical.
So far, so good. Thank you. We did get some angry email this week accusing us of not paying sufficient attention to baseball's defending champions, the Philadelphia Phillies. Do they seem to you poised to repeat?
Bill, they can repeat, but they have one major issue. Brad Lidge, their closer, has been unspeakably bad the entire season. Now, keep in mind, the reason they won last year, the biggest reason they won, is that Brad Lidge was unbelievably good. He was 41 for 41 in save opportunities. He has blown 11 saves this year. He is 0-8 with an ERA of 7.48, which is, by a mile, the highest ERA ever for anyone who's ever saved 30 games in a season. They did not lose a game last year that they led entering the ninth inning. This year, they've lost 11 such games, and they're still going to win their division, and they are still going to enter the playoffs as a very good team. But they are not going to repeat if Brad Lidge struggles in the postseason as he has struggled in the regular season.
Elsewhere in the National League, the Cardinals and Dodgers are coasting, and Colorado seems to have a grip on the wild card at this point. Can the Rockies hope to do any damage in October?
I don't think they're going to, but anything, as we know, is possible in baseball. Wild card teams have won the World Series several times in this decade, and the Rockies are a very hot team playing with a lot of momentum. But I personally think the Cardinals are the team to beat in the National League. They have arguably the two best pitchers in the whole league on their team in Chris Carpenter and Adam Wainwright. They have the best player in the whole game in Albert Pujols. I think they're poised to go to the World Series out of the National League. The Dodgers also have the potential to do that, although I must tell you, Bill, I saw them the other night in Washington, and the day I was with them, they were holding a team meeting because Joe Torre, the manager, was not pleased with the way the team had played the night before and needed to have a team meeting. That's usually not a good sign that they have to have a team meeting 9 days before the playoffs begin.
One of your favorite refrains, Tim, has always been the Yankees are still the Yankees. We have it on tape any number of times. They were the first team to clinch a postseason slot this time around. They will end the regular season with more wins than anybody else. Is this a team that can win everything?
The Yankees can win everything, Bill, and I think they'll go into the playoffs as the slight favorite to win the American League pennant. Their defense is demonstrably better than it was at this time last year, thanks mostly to Mark Teixeira at first base. They've scored more runs than any team in the major leagues. Their bullpen is way better than it was at this point last year, and their starting pitching potentially is very good. But their starting pitching is still the big question mark. CC Sabathia is an ace in the number one spot, but the question is A.J. Burnett, is he too erratic to be the number two starter? At times this year, he's been brilliant. In the month of August, he went 0-4 with an ERA over 6. If that one shows up, then the Yankees could have trouble because Andy Pettitte, their third starter, has had some injury issues. If they go to the playoffs unsettled at the number 2 and number 3 starter spot, they're not going to win the pennant.
Last year, Joe Maddon, the manager of the Tampa Bay Rays, was celebrated as a genius for getting his team to the World Series. This fall, the Rays, who aren't on the golf course, will be watching the playoffs on TV. How did Mr. Maddon get so dumb so fast?
First off, he's pretty close to a genius in a lot of ways, Bill. This is a guy who used the word ameliorate in a complete sentence last year. Believe me, in 30 years of covering baseball, that's a first for me. What happened to Joe Maddon this year was the expectations were a little greater than the talent level on his team. Meaning, I've done all the research on this. Teams that make that one huge jump, like the Rays did from 07 to 08, it's very difficult in baseball history to make another jump or even maintain, and that's what the Rays ran into. That and some injuries and some people just not playing up to expectations. But the point is, they have good young players. They will be back, but they ran into two teams that were simply better than them, the Yankees and the Red Sox.
Okay, specific question. In the American League Central, does Detroit ameliorate things and hold off the Twins?
Yes, and this is not hyperbole. Another word that Joe Maddon used in a complete sentence, the only other time I've heard a manager use that in a complete sentence in 30 years, he pronounced it hyperbole. So it just goes to show you how advanced Joe is in the English language. As for the Tigers, I think the Tigers are going to hang on and win. Keep in mind, when the Twins were four games back with 16 to play, only one other team in divisional play, that's 40 years, has come back to win a division being four games down with 16 to play. That was the 2007 Phillies. I think the Tigers are going to hold off the Twins, but I make no promises after that because I just don't think they're in the Yankees or the Red Sox or the Angels class going into the playoffs.
All right, Tim, you have spoken with great admiration of the Yankees and of the Cardinals, and it's time for you to make your final prediction. There are only a handful of teams left. How far wrong can you go at this point?
Well, I've been far wrong at this point, Bill, I can tell you that. I think the Cardinals are going to play the Yankees in the World Series. That's how I see it from here. Again, the Yankee starting pitching has to get a little bit better, and the Cardinals just have to make sure their 1-2 starters, Carpenter and Wainwright, are as good as we think they are. But there are a lot of great World Series out there, Bill. We could have Angels-Dodgers. We could have Red Sox-Dodgers, Manny coming back to Boston. We could have all sorts of great possibilities here. But I'm going to go with St. Louis and New York, and those are the two teams with the most World Series championships ever. That would be a pretty good combo right there.
You got a winner for us?
Yeah, I'm going to say the Yankees are going to win the World Series. Now, again, I've said that several times in this decade, and I haven't been right since 2000. So we'll see if my 8-year streak ends here. But that's what I'm saying, and I think A-Rod finally wins a ring, and I think it's time to change that subject at some point also.
Tim Kirchen talks and writes about baseball for ESPN, and he joins us here on Only a Game from time to time as well. Thank you, Tim.
Thank you, Bill.
Those who would dare challenge the National Football League have usually suffered the resulting humiliation and then disappeared as if they'd never been. Witness the histories of Arena Football Leagues 1 and 2, the XFL, and even the NFL Players Association. But none of those cautionary tales has stopped the brand new 4-team United Football League from giving it a try. The UFL will go head-to-head with the NFL for 6 weeks this fall. From member station KJZZ in Phoenix, Steve Goldstein reports.
It's a warm Thursday night in Casa Grande, Arizona, a 45-minute drive from Phoenix, and a professional football scrimmage is going on. Most of the Arizona Cardinals, last year's Super Bowl runners-up, study film or relax at home in preparation for their Sunday night showdown with Peyton Manning and the Indianapolis Colts. The lone exception is all-pro wide receiver Larry Fitzgerald. He's here in the middle of the desert to watch some wannabes and has-beens and diamonds in the rough, including his younger brother Marcus, who are preparing for the inaugural season of the United Football League. Commissioner Michael Hugue emerges from a golf cart to explain how the UFL will be able to fill a niche that the league claims the juggernaut NFL has somehow missed.
But this is really a league that has coined the phrase where future stars come to play. So they're not going to be known players per se, but I think that that's one of the beauty of it.
Hugue says that playing games in October and November notwithstanding, the UFL isn't trying to directly compete with the NFL. He won't say the UFL is a minor league, but his description does have a developmental sound to it.
because there's really not an efficient way for non-starters to get an opportunity to stay and hone their skills during the course of the season. And as you get to the third, fourth, fifth, and sixth week, it becomes even more dramatic in terms of the lack of conditioning.
According to Hugh, UFL players will have an advantage over NFL backups. They'll be in shape, ready to play, and eligible for the final 7 weeks or so of the NFL season. The UFL will have four teams when it kicks off the season on October 8th, the New York Sentinels, Florida Tuskers, California Redwoods, and Las Vegas Locomotives. Its final regular season game between New York and Las Vegas will be played in Los Angeles, a market that seems to have survived without a pro football team. The league's mission statement claims it will fulfill the unmet needs of football fans in major markets currently underserved by professional football. League founder Bill Hambrecht, who was a part owner of the USFL's Oakland Invaders in the 1980s, says we shouldn't be fooled into thinking that Bay Area and New York fans are getting enough football. He's very specific about his geography.
And in New York, you know, the two major teams are out in New Jersey. And Long Island and Westchester County and Connecticut, it's a lot of people live out there. So we think there's a real, when we say underserved markets, it may be in the same city like New York, but we do think that the NFL doesn't really provide a home team for that whole side of New York.
The UFL has signed a few name players with whom hardcore NFL fans may be familiar. Former Pro Bowl pass rusher Simeon Rice will play for the Sentinels, and quarterback J.P. Lossman, a starter for the Buffalo Bills in 2007, will conduct the offense for the Locomotives. But the league has yet to boast any splashy signings. CNBC Sports Business Analyst Darren Revelle.
I think it would have been a totally different story if Michael Vick slipped to the league. Then we would have that real gimmick that everyone would have to see.
Commissioner Michael Hugue agrees, but says speculation about Vick coming to the UFL prior to his signing with the Philadelphia Eagles has already helped increase the league's profile.
The fact that Michael Vick was in the media so much with us has really helped brand the league anyways. I think if you asked a lot of sports fans, football fans, have you heard of the UFL, the answer would be yes.
Hugue and Hambrecht say the league will measure success by the quality of play on the field, not attendance figures or television ratings. That may be a wise choice, according to Scott Rosner of the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania. Rosner thinks the U.S. appetite for football is well fed by Friday night high school games, Saturday college games, and the NFL on Sundays and Mondays, and the odd Thursday or Saturday.
Quite frankly, it's a simple economics question. Has the supply of available football in the United States in the fall meeting the demand? My, I guess, somewhat educated answer to that question is yes, it is.
League founder Bill Hambrecht says the UFL's conservative approach, in combination with high-quality football, can make it a success. He also makes clear that regardless of the NFL's hold on pro football in the autumn, that's when the UFL needs to play. The UFL will make its first public attempt to be more than a footnote in sports history when its season kicks off on October 8th, when the Las Vegas Locomotives try to chop down the California Redwoods. For Only a Game, I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix.
It's 19 minutes past the hour.
Car 54, where are you?
In some respects, the recent raid on a convicted drug dealer's home in Lakeland, Florida, was a success. The officers conducting the raid found lots of evidence to catalog. So much evidence, in fact, that they took several breaks from their work, and during those breaks, they used the drug dealer's Nintendo Wii to bowl lots of games against each other. We know this because the bowling officers were caught on a surveillance video. The video equipment was set up last March, apparently not by the same officers who were bowling. But what if they were the same officers? That would be great.
Jam in Harlem that's backed up to Jackson Heights. There's a scout troop short, a child cruises to an idle wild.
Car 54, where are you?
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the Rocket Montreal style. But first, all across the country, high school track teams aspire to win state championships. For the past 2 years, lots of high schools in Texas have had to be content with fighting for second place because each of the past two Class 1A track championships in Texas has been won by a single individual all by herself, which explains why Gary Smith's story of Bonnie Richardson is titled The Power of One. The story is in this week's Sports Illustrated. Gary Smith joins me now from Charleston, South Carolina. Welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill.
And we're joined by Jim Dennis, Bonnie Richardson's former track coach. He's now the principal of Rochelle High School in Rochelle, Texas. Jim, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Jim, I want to start with you. You drove your track team, which consisted of Bonnie Richardson, to and from the first state championship that she won, and, of course, you witnessed her performance. How did she do it?
You know, she's one of those kids that does not like to lose, and, you know, she's going to do whatever she can to win. That's the best I can get out of it is her raw talent and will to win.
Just to be as precise as we can, she runs, she jumps, she does everything except run the relay because I gather they won't let her run all four laps of the relay all by herself.
Correct.
There was a good deal of tension at the final event of the 2009 state championship meet, and Bonnie wasn't even involved in that competition because, of course, that last event was the relay. How did she and her fans handle having to just watch that final relay?
We were hoping that she would win the state title by herself, so, you know, we didn't want to root against the other team. We just wanted to root for the other seven teams they ran against to do a little better.
What Jim doesn't mention was that Bonnie was sitting on a curb not watching virtually the whole race. She didn't want anything to do with it until the very end. She got up and started rooting for the other girl to get the points in that race that would take the crown away from Bonnie. So she comes out a little different than most athletes you know.
Gary, did you get the impression that winning two state track championships in a row made Bonnie happy?
No, I think having it done and out of the way made her happy. I think the biggest smile that I heard that she had all day was when she jumped into the swimming pool that night when it was all over and done, and she could just shrug it all off and be done with it. Being thrust in front of everyone and having everybody make a big fuss, it just undercuts her whole, I think, her whole motivation. She climbs all over herself and thinks she's not doing good enough. And so to have everybody, you know, slapping her on the back and turning her into some kind of princess, that just totally erodes what her whole internal combustion in a way, what makes her go.
Gary, Bonnie's achievements have inspired all sorts of reactions. You write, and I'm quoting now, the hands-down barrel-bottom worst of those reactions, at least from Bonnie's point of view, occurred at church one Sunday. What was going on there?
Well, the minister called Bonnie to stand up, and the choir had prepared this song. It was to the tune of Our Bonnie Lies Over the Ocean, and it was one of those songs that kind of makes you feel like somebody just scratched chalk across the board. If you're 18 years old and they're crooning and screeching about you, how high and long you jump, and most of it didn't quite rhyme. But anyway, Bonnie just wanted to drill a hole in the earth and just go through the other side of the world at that point. Her parents knew that was going to be the worst thing that anybody could have done, and it was all meant well by the minister over there, but she told me that was the worst of many dark moments she had after winning that thing.
Out of all of this, that was her worst moment, all of it, and I can just picture her in church, you know.
What was her best moment? Was it the swimming pool moment that Gary mentions, Coach, or was there something else?
Her best moment might have been just getting away from it all and going back to, I say, a normal lifestyle, you know, this lifestyle where she didn't have reporters and having to deal with running and track.
Well, what Coach Dennis calls back to her normal life is hardly the normal life most of us would think of. For Bonnie, a normal life is going out and spending 8 hour days slamming a sledgehammer and breaking up concrete to dig a new water line and put 100 more yards of fence post down and driving the cattle in for weighing and shipping and eating dust all day and then getting a bow and arrow and going after an 8-point buck. That's Bonnie getting back to normal lifestyle.
That's right. It's not normal, I guess, for everybody, but that's our normal Bonnie and doing that kind of stuff.
Well, I'm very glad that I'm talking to you two guys and not putting Bonnie through what would be the misery of being on Only a Game. But, geez, Gary, being in Sports Illustrated is going to up her profile a little bit. I hope it doesn't make her too uncomfortable.
Yeah, I was cringing the whole way as I was writing, picturing her seeing this story, actually. it's one of those paradoxes. What she's done is amazing, and she's really an extraordinary person, one of the most driven and competitive young people I've ever met in my life. And knowing that she deserved this kind of attention, but that it would make her skin crawl was a kind of a creepy feeling at the typewriter.
Exactly. I know she doesn't like it, but I think she deserves every bit of it.
Gary, you knew before you met Bonnie that she was not only an accomplished track athlete, but that she also played basketball and tennis, and as you say, she hunted deer with a bow and arrow. But how did you learn that her real passion was for another sport altogether, namely football?
Well, the stories kind of abound at school about that being what she loved the most. I mean, her parents were just afraid that she'd be a target out on the field, that, you know, that after they'd gotten knocked over a few times by her, the boys on the other teams would make her pay the price for that. It still pinches them to have to say no to her. They don't like to say no to that girl, and their whole philosophy about their family is to go for it in life. So that was hands down what Bonnie wanted to do most. And, you know, she quickly told me that she would have given away all these track medals and team titles if she could have played high school football.
Jim, Bonnie is at Texas A&M now. She's joined an exceptional track team there. Will she be comfortable being just one of a number of very good athletes on a team, having been a one-woman team?
Oh, most definitely. I think, you know, if she has some teammates around her, then I think she'll be able to probably enjoy it a lot more, you know, when other girls will be getting attention and it won't all be, you know, squirreling on her. I just think that she'll probably love it.
Gary Smith wrote The Power of One, the story of how Bonnie Richardson single-handedly won the Texas Class 1A State High School Track Championship. That story is in the current issue of Sports Illustrated, and Gary Smith spoke to me from Charleston, South Carolina. Gary, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bill.
And I've also been speaking with Bonnie Richardson's former coach, Jim Dennis, who's now the principal of the high school in Rochelle, Texas. Jim, thanks very much for joining me.
You're welcome.
To experience Only a Game's magical web world, please visit onlyagame.org. He had the eyes of a man possessed. His sole idea was to score goals, and he scored enough of them to break records. But the premise of a new book titled The Rocket, A Cultural History of Maurice Richard, is that the impact and influence of the most formidable player ever to skate for the Montreal Canadiens extended far beyond what Richard was able to do with a stick in his hands and the puck at his feet. Joining me now from the CBC in Montreal is Benoit Melançon, the author of The Rocket. Welcome to Only a Game.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
In researching the impact Maurice Richard had on opponents and on teammates, you found that a lot of them talked about his eyes. What did they say?
This is very striking. People mentioned Maurice Richard's eyes as soon as he started to play in 1942, and people still mention them today. Usually what they mean is pure determination. He had, you know, the strength. He put every effort he could into the game, and that showed in his eyes. The thing that helped is the fact that he wouldn't speak, or very little. So actually, he did his talking with his eyes, and people were really impressed by those eyes. It's really the main trait of Maurice Richard. This is how people remember him.
Maurice Richard played for the Canadiens from 1942 until 1960. Montreal won 8 Stanley Cups while he was playing, including 5 in a row during the final 5 seasons of his career, which is quite a statistic. To what extent was Richard personally responsible for that success?
During all his career, he was scoring goals all the time. So this is what he did. What he really did is he took his teams on his shoulders and carried the team throughout many seasons. While the Canadiens won those 5 cups in a row, he was fading away. I mean, he was at the end of his career. But still, he was carrying the torch. He was the team leader. And that was very clear.
When did it first become apparent that in terms of what he represented, Maurice Richard had begun to enter the culture of his time in various ways that transcended hockey?
It happened very early on. Actually, the first time someone said that Maurice Richard was a myth in Canada was in 1956. He was still an active player. And they were using that word because he was also depicted everywhere. He had all kinds of products to his name. You know, you would sell soup cans of soup with Maurice Richard's name on it. You would sell bread. You would sell clothes. You would sell pencils. There are, just in French, about 30 songs written about Maurice Richard from the 1940s to, let's say, today, because there are songs that were released in early 2009. He was everywhere. He was the epitome of what a hockey player could be.
You spend a lot of time in the book discussing the response to Maurice Richard's suspension in 1955. The shorthand term for that response is, of course, the riot. Tell us about that.
Well, that happened, Bill, precisely in your backyard. It started on March 13, 1955. The Canadians were playing the big bad Bruins at the Garden. There was a fight. Everybody agrees about that. Maurice Richard did get into a fight with a Bruins player named Al Lico. He uses fists, but he also uses stick. And there, the stories vary quite a bit. People would say, well, he used one stick. And people would say, well, no, he used actually two sticks. He broke two sticks on Al Lico's back. People say, now, probably there were three sticks. And the latest version I found is four sticks he broke. This is why he is a myth. He also, not only did he hit Al Lico, but he also hit a referee. He was suspended for the three remaining games of the season and for all the playoffs. And on the 17th, there was a game against Detroit in Montreal. And so people gathered in front of the old forum in Montreal. The game started. A tear gas was dropped, so people had to leave. And then the riot broke out on the streets of Montreal. Cars were overturned, newspaper stands were burned down, some stores were vandalized. And people would say from then on that this was the day Francophones, French-speaking Quebecers, and Anglophones really got into some kind of clear opposition, some kind of war. I disagree with that interpretation, but this is what you read most of the time.
Was it apparent right away that in the riot there were elements of nationalism and resentment of the English-speaking commissioner of the National Hockey League, Clarence Campbell?
It's obvious that there was a nationalist tone to the riot. Nobody could argue otherwise. There were lots of Francophone hockey fans in the street that night who were rioting because their hero had been unduly suspended. But then there were lots of Anglophones in the streets also, and you have to remember one thing. That riot took place on March 17th. This is St. Patrick's Day. People were celebrating on the streets of Montreal, and it so happened that at the same time a riot broke out. So it's obvious it is a nationalist event. But what I try to argue and demonstrate in the book is that there was also a big Montreal dimension to the riot. This was one city behind its hero. Thing is, people try to forget today that Maurice Richard was quite a difficult character in his time. I mean, he was not a very nice guy on the ice, so he had been suspended numbers of times. So it was a long war that was brewing between himself and Clarence Campbell.
In the U.S., lots of athletes have become larger than the games they played. Babe Ruth comes to mind, of course, and Jim Thorpe, and much more recently, Michael Jordan for basketball. You write that Richard constantly said of himself that he was only a hockey player, but surely he must have been aware of the mythical status assigned to him by some people. Did you get a sense at all of what he could make of it?
I think he didn't really understand exactly the extent. He died in the year 2000 in May, but every day or so in a Montreal newspaper, you would find Maurice Richard's name still today. I mean, I entered the CBC studio a few minutes ago for this interview, and in the hall of the CBC, there is one big hockey sweater from Maurice Richard. Even after Wayne Gretzky, after Mario Lemieux, after Sidney Crosby, you still go with Maurice Richard. This is what he is still today. And of course, this is something he couldn't really understand. I mean, at one time, which is very striking, he felt that he would be forgotten. He was afraid of that. And then, let's say, end of the 60s, early 70s, he said, well, someday people won't recognize me anymore, which was totally, of course, untrue. Throughout the years, his meaning changed, but he was still there, and he was there to the very end.
I'm speaking with Benoit Melançon, author of The Rocket, and you're listening to Only a Game. You characterize the people of Quebec as follows in the book. Nothing in the eyes of Quebec is more touching, more familiar, closer to home than the success of one of its divas, one of its circuses, or one of its participants in flashy sports. Divas, that would explain the photos in your book of singers Celine Dion and Shania Twain, both wearing Maurice Richard number 9 jerseys while they're performing, I guess.
Exactly. Celine Dion wore that number 9 sweater one night in Montreal while she was singing, and Maurice Richard was in the stands. So she was singing to Maurice Richard. And, of course, both cried. It was depicted in the papers the next day. You know, Shania Twain is different. She comes from English-speaking Canada, and she used that sweater one night when she was awarded some kind of prize, and she wanted to say, I'm a real Canadian, I know my national sport, and I know my national heroes. And this is why she chose Maurice Richard's sweater.
According to the afterword of your book, written by one of Richard's teammates, Jean Béliveau, over 1 million people lined the streets of Montreal to pay their respects to Richard after he died. Had there ever been such a mass demonstration of love and respect in Canada before?
Not of that magnitude, but similar events. Both were in the 1930s. One was after the death of an other hockey player, Howie Morenz, who died after being hit on the ice at the Montreal Forum, I think in 1937. And about the same time, there was a priest who died in Montreal, and people said that he would do miracles. So when he died, people also gathered along the streets to celebrate. But not 1 million people. There were those people on the streets, lining up the streets when he died. There were all those people who would stand in the sun for hours just to go and walk in front of Maurice Richard's casket. Figures are about 115,000 people did. And people would gather in different places of the city. They would bring souvenirs. They would write letters to Maurice Richard. They would bring hockey sticks. People really wanted to do something personal, something special, something intimate, because Maurice Richard was so important to them, even though they had never seen him play and their parents had never seen him play. This, I think, is unique in the history of the French Quebec.
Benoit Melançon is the author of The Rocket, A Cultural History of Maurice Richard, published by Greystone. He joined me from the studios of the CBC in Montreal. Professor, thank you very much for speaking with me.
It was my pleasure.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. And AVFX, Boston-based and serving the nation with audiovisual staging tools at corporate meetings, trade shows, and live events. Location information at avfx.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Apparently impatient with how long it was taking Russian soccer power Spartak Moscow to take advantage of the penalty kick the team had been awarded in last weekend's game against FC Saturn, a Spartak fan jumped out of the stands, rushed toward the ball, and slammed it past the surprised Saturn goalie and into the net. As the delighted fan ran a celebratory lap around the field, the crowd cheered and chanted. A few minutes later, Spartak scored on the official penalty kick, though they lost the game 2-1. Unless you count the goal scored by the fan, in which case the game ended in a 2-2 tie. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, laughing yoga, or at least laughing. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for Look the Week's News. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
The Patriots lost to the Jets last weekend for a less-than-perfect 1-1 start, so we shouldn't be surprised that some of our colleagues in the press have announced that New England quarterback Tom Brady's best days are behind him, should we?
Well, I think that people are looking ahead and seeing Atlanta in town and then Baltimore with its formidable defense in town, and the possibility that the Patriots might be beginning the season 1-3. I personally don't think Tom Brady's healthy. I think his knee is as good as it has to be to get him to play football, and not much more than that, and his arm doesn't seem at all right from getting dumped on it by Albert Haynesworth. Tom Brady could show up at the training camp without his head, and the Patriots would say he was probable for Sunday. So there's no point in trying to get anything out of the team, but he does not look physically right to me.
David Givens, former wide receiver for the Tennessee Titans,
and
is
the New
suing
England Patriots.
And the Patriots before that. He's suing the Titans for $25 million. He contends that if he had known what the doctor employed by the Titans knew, he could have avoided a career-ending knee injury. Does he have a case?
He does, because there's a memo that pretty much indicates that the team physician was concerned about Givens' ability to play a full season because of the damage done to his knee. This once again highlights the fact that any doctor who becomes a quote-unquote NFL team doctor is more part of the NFL team than he is a doctor and should mail his diploma back to Hippocrates immediately.
Michael Vick makes his official return to the NFL on Sunday. Charlie, this week Vick told CBS that he originally had expected to be a starter when he came back to the league. Instead, he's one of three backups who, might run a couple of plays. That sound about right to you?
It sounds about right for the pregame analysis. Kevin Cobb, the backup to Donovan McNabb, who will not be playing, he doesn't practice this week, hasn't really done the job. It's not likely he's going to. Michael Vick will be the quarterback of that team as long as Donovan McNabb isn't very, very soon.
Tony Seminary, a fan of the University of Oregon football team, was so discouraged by that team's performance back on September 3rd, the day upon which LeGarrette Blount assaulted one of Boise State's players, that Mr. Seminary asked Coach Chip Kelly for a refund of the money that he had spent to attend the game, tickets and transportation. How do you make out?
Tom Kelly sent him a check, a personal check for the full amount, which Mr. Seminary was so impressed by, he sent the money back without cashing the check. I think you've got two very classy gentlemen having a little fun with each other. And if I was Oregon, I'd make Tony Seminary a deal on 50-yard line club seats immediately.
Chicago Cubs outfielder Milton Bradley was suspended for the remainder of the season for, quote, unspecified actions, one of those apparently telling a reporter that the team lacked a positive environment. Didn't take much perception to figure that out. After Bradley was sent home, the Cubs started winning. Coincidence?
Who knows? Probably. But, I mean, this is just very strange to me. There must be an ongoing – I mean, there's obviously an ongoing problem with Milton Bradley at every stop that he's made in the major leagues. But it must have really gotten bad for them to suspend him for essentially saying something.
When the Red Sox visited Kansas City during the week, Randy Aaron Barker, who was incarcerated in Iowa, was granted a temporary release so that he could attend the ball game. You don't suppose Magistrate Judge Benny Wagoner is a Red Sox fan, do you?
I don't know, but I think Judge Benny Wagoner better beware the wrath of whatever talk hosts there are in his particular little part of Iowa. This is a really dumb move. I'm sorry. I'm sorry you planned this for months in advance, but maybe you shouldn't have violated the restraining order.
I'm just wondering if this guy would have gotten out to see, the Twins, the Oakland A's.
He probably would have stayed in if he was a Pirates fan.
The New Jersey, perhaps soon-to-be Brooklyn Nets, have a new owner. His name is Mikhail Prokhorov, and he's reportedly the richest man in Russia. I wonder if we have reached the time to which Mr. Khrushchev was alluding when he said, "We will bury you."
I don't mean to be xenophobic, but Russia has been a kleptocracy for about 20 years. If you are the richest man in Russia, what can possibly go wrong with this? More to the point, the people in Russia aren't happy. There's a member of the Upper Parliament Chamber's Sports Committee. Don't you wish the United States Senate had a sports committee? Jim Bunning would not fall asleep.
It does.
If
they
he
came
was on
out
the
against
committee.
Steroids.
He said he can't consider this action anything but unpatriotic. We have talented children here, but sports isn't being developed. They're not trying in order for us to return to our former sports ranking of best in the world. You know what? That's the problem. They should bring the USSR back as a sports club.
Hmm.
Not as a government or not as an economic system, but as a way to develop athletes. They were really good at that.
Charlie, the great one is no longer in charge of the troubled Phoenix Coyotes. Wayne Gretzky says that neither bidder for the team is interested in keeping him on as coach, and so he might as well step down now. Do you think either the NHL, one bidder, or Canadian billionaire Jim Balsillie will be more interested in retaining the services of Gretzky's replacement, former Dallas coach Dave Tippett?
Well, I don't know, but Gretzky was pretty much at the end of his rope in Phoenix. That place has been a circus for a long time. Nobody's really sure who's going to wind up owning the team. I think they're both better off apart.
Speaking of Jim Balsillie, he has now strengthened his bid to buy the Coyotes, saying that if a bankruptcy court rules in his favor, he will pay the city of Glendale $25 million, which the city will get to keep even if the NHL wins the team back on appeal. Glendale will likely lose the team either way, so why don't they back Balsillie?
I don't know. I have lost track of this story so many times over the last couple of years. If somebody in the NHL really doesn't want Jim Balsillie owning a team, the Coyotes are a basket case. And you would think the league would want anyone to take them off his hands. Perhaps they're looking around for the second richest man in Russia.
Competition is always good,
absolutely,
even between the two richest people in Russia. Regular Only a Game listeners know that the two shoe companies, Adidas and Puma, were founded by feuding brothers in a small city in Germany, and that feud went on for many decades. On Monday, International Peace Day, co-ed teams from the two companies played a soccer match in order to put an end to the feud. Who won?
We don't know. You know why? Because it was a friendly,
they
Bill.
They won't tell us.
They won't tell us. I think if they really wanted to show they're involved in the spirit of International Peace Day, both sides would have worn New Balance shoes.
And finally, Charlie, any fool knows that it's illegal to litter in our national parks.
Not any fool, Bill. I can name one.
Although now you can bring a loaded gun into the national park if you wish to. But 57-year-old Douglas Jones felt that he was honoring golfers with his recent actions in Joshua Tree National Park. Do you think golfers everywhere appreciated what Mr. Jones was up to?
Sports? I always ask this because sometimes I'm unclear. Mr. Jones was throwing golf balls into Joshua Tree National Park. Apparently, he was doing them to honor golfers who are dead. I'm sure some golfer who's dead is very honored by this. But the interesting thing is he also was leaving cans of food and canned vegetables lying around for stranded hikers.
Of course.
Shouldn't he leave can openers around for the stranded hikers?
Or perhaps water.
Easy open water.
Given that it's a desert.
I applaud Mr. Jones's initiative, but I think his execution is a bit long.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Think about the poor roadrunners trying to hatch them.
The official history of laughter yoga has it that the practice began in India with just five people telling jokes to each other in a park. After a few weeks, a crowd had gathered for the daily laughter sessions, but the jokes had run out, so people began laughing over nothing at all. We hear it Only a Game laugh often, but can we laugh for no reason? Our own Karen Given arranged for a laughter yoga session and invited along some others from the offices here at WBUR.
We need you to laugh.
The British laugh.
Bring your friends.
Yes.
I am Sandy Boris Berkowitz, certified laughter yoga leader.
So tell me the history of this, what would we call it, a sport, an activity?
I like to call it all, a sport, a game, an activity, medicine. Laughter encompasses everything and everyone. In 1995, a doctor by the name of Dr. Madin Kateria got a group of people together, and they would meet in the parks and start laughing. At first, people thought that was a little strange, but it caught on. Lo and behold, 15 or whatever it is years later, there are now over 6,000 laughing clubs all over the world. What I'd like to do is start this session with everyone standing up. And before we all begin laughing... Oh, this is a great group. We haven't even done anything yet.
I'm Gary Wallach. I'm senior producer of NPR's Only a Game. I don't know all that much about the wide world of yoga, and this was actually my entree into that world.
If you want to be a cheerleader, you can pick up a pom-pom. Or if you want to be a musician, you can pick up a music maker. Or if you just want to clap your hands, you can do that. Feel free to do whatever you'd like.
As people sort of came into the class not knowing what to expect, I mean, there was quite a bit of laughter before we even started.
Yeah, the idea is inherently funny. I mean, it sort of starts working before you even meet the instructor.
She starts handing grown men pom-poms, and everyone's got to laugh, right?
Exactly. And maracas. I mean, maracas takes the kitsch level up pretty high, too.
Can I have a volunteer, please?
Bianca.
Then what we're going to do is we're going to demonstrate the exercise. And the real thing is, ideally, after we do the high five, we're going to laugh. And if you don't think this is funny, it doesn't matter. Fake it until you make it. Your body will reap the same benefits, and laughing is contagious, okay? So on the count of three, high five and laugh. One, two, three. Okay, go up to people in the room, give them a high five and laugh.
I am Doug Trabue, associate producer of Only a Game.
The forced laughter part is interesting to me, that the idea that you can go in and just force it, and then eventually it starts to come naturally. You start laughing at the absurdity of what you're doing. I see how it was working, because everybody ended up laughing. I did end up laughing at quite a few points.
And the Laughing Yoga and Laughing Matters chant is ho, ho, ha, ha, ha. Ho, ho, ha, ha. And end it with a yay!
Yay! Sports comes in. Sports. A sports story. It's good.
I'm Bill Littlefield, the host of Only a Game, National Public Radio's sports program.
Is laughter yoga a sport?
There's no question about it. It is a sport. It's competitive. I was trying to laugh funnier than everyone else, and Kelvin Brooks was trying to laugh louder than everyone else, and I'm kidding. Obviously, it's not a competitive sport. It's just fun.
Wonderful, great laughs. Can I have another volunteer?
Bill.
Yes. Okay, the next laugh we're going to do, I call this argumentative laughter. Shake your finger, pretend you're in an argument, and then start laughing.
Okay? All right.
On the count of three.
I'm looking at you.
At me. Okay. It's important to give eye contact with the person that you're laughing with.
Okay.
One, two, three.
One of the exercises we did was argumentative laughter, which we were told we're supposed to do before arguing about anything. So
right.
Do you think, you know, maybe our next story meeting, when you suggest the women's soccer story, we should just all laugh?
Well, it's okay if you all laugh when I suggest the next women's soccer story, but you mustn't shake your fingers at me. I didn't like that part. I don't like the shaking the fingers, but the laughing was good.
Yay! Are you all feeling it in your bellies? A little bit of a workout?
My actually, smile muscles are getting short.
And that happens too. And actually, there I've read some studies where it's like you can lose like 4 pounds a year if you laugh, a hearty laugh. I think it's 15 minutes a day. So, can I have a volunteer, please?
Kelvin should be your next volunteer.
Kelvin Brooks, corporate underwriting.
Alistair Drummond, corporate underwriting.
Laughter is infectious, you know, and I can see when we're going through the exercises of just laughing, you know, I started and I wasn't into it at first, but then I couldn't stop.
It was definitely contagious, and once you get on a roll, it definitely adds a nice part to your day.
Kelvin, you're not really the yoga type of guy, right?
No. My wife is a certified yoga instructor, and she's been trying to get me to practice yoga for the past year and a half, and I've been resistant. And I really didn't think that laughter yoga was so real. Yeah, and I went and talked to her about it. She says, yes, it's real. I was, you know, I was shocked. It was not the yoga I was expecting.
Yeah.
No downward dog and eagle and crow.
And tell me about the yoga element, because you don't wear yoga pants. There's
nope.
No downward dog.
The yoga component really is the breathing, and it's really doing some deep breaths, which will get you in a restful state, a really thoughtful state. Often I think it is confusing for some people, but for those yogis, it's kind of like another nice form of yoga, where you're really exercising your mind, your brain, and your body by doing hearty belly laughs. Put your feet on the floor, your hands on your lap, close your eyes, and take a deep breath in through your nose, expanding your stomach like a balloon.
My name is Clint Kavanaugh, and I'm a leadership gifts officer. I had heard of it, and I thought it sounded really corny. I just didn't think that it was anything that I'd like. I saw a little bit of a piece on it on TV, and I thought, that looks really dumb. The whole philosophy of it is it feels so good, and it does feel good. Once you start laughing, you just kind of don't want to stop because it feels really good to do it. I mean, just try it. It's good.
You put your left foot in, you put your left foot out, you put your left foot in, and you shake it all about.
And you do. You get up and you jump around, especially when we did the Hokey Pokey. You jumped around. I said just about something about the Hokey Pokey to somebody, and they said, I don't know what that is.
That's so sad.
You don't know the Hokey Pokey? So I had to do it again.
It was fun. That's what it's all about.
That's working up here. You just never know.
Our piece on laughter yoga was produced by Only a Game's Karen Gibbon.
Some laugh too fast. Some only blast. Ah! Others, they twitter like birds.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Tribou. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our intern is Jeremy Bernfeld. We had help from CBC Montreal. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view Karen Given's Laughter Yoga Photo Gallery, download our weekly podcasts, learn more about the music you hear on our program, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word is from NHL Commissioner Gary Bettman, who says that Phoenix is a perfect place for an NHL team. Laughter Yoga Strikes Again. Is Bettman a certified instructor? I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
We love to laugh. Loud and long and clear. We love to laugh. So everybody can hear. The more you laugh, oh my God, the more you fill with glee. The more the glee, the more we're a merry
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.